I'd like to introduce our main speaker for tonight, Don C. from Colorado Springs, Colorado.
My name is Don C. I am an alcoholic. Well, I'm never going to forget this experience. You guys are awesome. I remember when I first got the call to come to Iquipa, I thought I was coming to a tribe. And it's true, I did. I know I was sitting up here watching all of you, and I was thinking, you made a wish pop in my head, and I thought, if Iquipa could hit our young people in Indian country, it would be awesome to see them like you. To see you sober and having fun and dancing and laughing. And when you stand up, you can actually feel that energy come up here. Have you noticed that? It's just like it hits you. I thought, whoa, what is this power these guys have? It's pretty awesome. My name is Don C. I am a member of the Mohican Nation. And our nation is made up of clans. Thank you. And I was born for the Turtle Clan on my mother's side. That's an Ojibwe back there. No, I'm kidding. And my Indian name is Tantanka Wambli. You guys are just awesome. I have 8 children. I have 6 daughters, 2 sons. I have 17 grandchildren. My oldest children, they were in Alateen, and now, thanks to you, my daughters come through Iquipa, and they still are a member of that. But I was taught that whenever you do this, you just share your experience, strength, and hope. And so to tell a story of what happened, what that was like, and what it's like now. And maybe the best way I could explain that story is to tell a story. The story, originally, I heard it from a man named Don P. out of Denver. He was one of my first sponsors, and I didn't get sober. I didn't stay sober when I first came to AA. I slipped a number of times, and one night, this man, he said, there's this Indian guy speaking up in Estes Park, which is a little town outside of Colorado, outside of Denver, and so I went up there, and Don P. was speaking there, and it was one of those situations where, like in our language, we have a word when someone something connects. In our language, we call it netashniha, and that means like when you look someone in the eye, then there's a feeling goes across, that connectedness. That's what I felt from you tonight. You're all connected with this netashniha, and it's very strong when you're all connected together. Anyway, Don P. and I, we looked at one another, and he got this big smile on his face, and that connectedness was there, and it stayed there forever. It never, never went away. But he told a story. And in our culture, if somebody has a song and they give you that song, then you have to say where that song came from. Otherwise, you lose the spirit of it. So I can't say, this is my song. So it's like this story. I have to tell you how I got the story, and I got it from Don P. But it was a story about this boxing match. And there was this arena, and in one corner was, in white trunks was alcohol, in the other corner, in the black trunks was me. And we sat in that arena, and people started to come into the arena and fill up the seating. And of course, what they do in those types of events is they put a ribbon, a reserved ribbon, and they put this reserved ribbon in the first row, and that is usually a space that is reserved for your family, so your family gets the best view. And so my family came in, and they all sat right in that first row, and there would come time to start the match, and the referee, he called us both out to the center, and I was looking at this alcohol, and somehow, right from the beginning, I was attracted to it, that netashneha. I was connected to it. And the referee explained, there's some rules, he said, when you do this, he says, no hitting below the belt, and when I say break, break, and this alcohol had this look on its face, and I just kept staring at this alcohol, and so we got done listening to the rules. We all agreed, went sit down, and so the bell rang, and we got out, and we started dancing around and boxing at each other, and first round or two, that wasn't too bad. It was actually a lot of fun, and so it was all right. And so by the third round, we got out there, and I don't know how it happened, but I must have ducked the wrong way, but the alcohol took a swing, and it punched me right in the face, and it stung. And I looked at the alcohol, and he says, oh, that was just a lucky punch. He says, you can whip me. And deep into my innermost self, I knew the alcohol had just told me the truth. I knew I was going to be able to win that contest. And so the next round come out, we're dancing around, boxing around, and all of a sudden he snuck a couple of punches in. It stung, kind of swelled up my eye a little bit. And as I sat down there during the break, I look at that alcohol, and I was trying to figure out, there was something going on with me and that alcohol. And as I looked, I kind of noticed out the side of my eye, people started to leave. I guess because they could see what the end result of that was going to be. And so by the time we got to the next rounds, the alcohol was hitting below the belt, and the referee didn't call him on nothing. Punching away, my eyes were swelling shut, I was bruising. And each time the alcohol punched like that, he said, you can whip me. And he had this look on his face, so convincing, and I knew I was going to be able to do that. And so I was sit down by the time round 8 or 9 or so, and I'm trying to strategize now. I'm trying to think of what my moves are going to be, because I got to whip this alcohol. And as I sat there strategizing, I was staring at him, and I felt this tug on my arm. And I looked down, and it was my son. And I said, what? He said, Dad, he says, Mom says to tell you, just come down, let's all go home. Just come on, he said, come on, Dad, let's go home. He said, you're bruised up pretty bad. And I looked at him, and I said, you go back and you tell your mama, your brothers and sisters, you just tell them one more round. I'm going to make my move in this round. I want you guys to watch. So I got out there, and by this time the alcohol is stomping, and my knees are weak, and it's kicking, and the referee isn't saying anything, and I was very wobbly. And so the bell rang, and I come back, and I sit down, and I look at the alcohol, and it's like he was lip syncing. You know, you're like, you can whip me. And I said, I know I can, you know. And so as I'm sitting there really thinking of what my moves are, I felt this tug of my arm. And I looked down there, and this time it was one of my daughters. big tears in her eyes. And she said, Dad, she said, Mama says to tell you, just come down, let's all go home. But she said to tell you, if you don't, we're going to leave. We're not going to watch no more. And I looked down at her and I said, you tell your mama, and I want you kids to watch. I said, I've got some Indian moves I'm going to make. And so I got out there, and to the best of my ability, I made those Indian moves, and it didn't work. And I was crawling on my hands and knees out there, and all I could see of the alcohol was just the alcohol's tennis shoes. I couldn't even raise up, and he's screaming, you can whip me, you can whip me. I don't know for sure the moment during that round when my family left. But when I looked, there was no one left in that arena. There was just me and alcohol. And so I crawled out of that arena. And I started going to Barnes and Nobles. I got me some good self-help books. And I started to exercise. And I started to meditate. And I started to feel good. Then one Saturday, this idea popped in my head. I said, you know something? I know another move. I think I'm going to go back in the arena and just see if the alcohol is there. And I went back there. Sure enough, the alcohol is standing in that ring, his arms on the ropes. I said, alcohol, I am back. He said, I knew you would be. You just come on in here. And this time, the alcohol, he didn't even let me in the ring. Just pounced on me as I was coming through the rings, putting me on my knees right away, and I was looking at his tennis shoes almost instantly. So I crawled out of the arena again. And I got thinking, I went to the wrong bookstore. So I went to a different bookstore, and I got some different books, and I did different exercises, and I was really in shape. And I got thinking. I said, I think I know another Indian move. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to show the alcohol some old traditional stuff. But I got back there, and you know the story. He didn't let me in the ring. Just put me down right away. And so on August 10th, 1978, I crawled out of that arena, and I haven't been back in there since. All the things I had tried with the drinking, there was one thing I had not tried. I had heard some things about it, and that was AA. And I didn't want to go to AA. That time I was living in Colorado Springs, and there's a street there called Cajon Street. And I went down there in the afternoon. I spotted where the meeting was. It was upstairs, and in those days they parked the cars diagonal. And so I didn't tell no one I was going. So I went down, scoped it out. So about 7:45, I drove down there. And there was one parking spot right in front of the AA door. And I said to myself, I'm going to drive around the block. And if that slot is there, then that's a sign I'm supposed to go in there. And so as I come around the block, that slot, it was still there, and everybody seemed to be parking on the other darn side. So I stopped my car. At home, when you got an old beat-up car, they called it a res car, like reservation car, duct tape and all that stuff on it. You call it a res car. So I had a res car then. So I stopped that res car, and I thought, you know, I'm going to drive around the block just one more time. If that slot is there, then it's really a sign I'm supposed to go in there. So I drove around that block just slow as that darn rest car would go. Sure enough, I come around, that slot's empty. So I parked in there, and I went into the AA room. And I walked in that room, and they had a greeter. I think that greeter wasn't there I wouldn't have went in. Because I looked in that door and I said, oh my God, this is all white people in here. And as I was backing away, this big old greeter grabbed my hand, and before I know it, I was sitting in a chair with a cup of coffee in my hand, and I couldn't figure out how to talk my way out of that. So I sat there and I said, okay, I said, I ain't going to tell these white people nothing. So I remember they go around and say, my name's so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, whatever. And when they come to me, I say nothing. I just sat there. And they kind of waited, and pretty soon the next guy just took over, you know, and went around the room. And I was really analyzing that meeting, I think. And there was a couple of things went on there I almost got a resentment about sitting there watching them. One was, is they were telling on themselves. I'm self-centered and I'm self-righteous and I'm judgmental. And I thought to myself, what the hell is the matter with these guys telling on themselves like that? Where I come from, you never told nobody nothing about being weak. You didn't do that. The second thing I got a resentment about in that first meeting was the laughter. They just laughed like hell in there all through that meeting, and there was nothing was funny as far as I was concerned. But the third thing was in that meeting, and I didn't know it for probably a couple of years, is there was a feeling in there. I couldn't understand what that feeling was because it was coming from white people. But whatever that was, it made me want to come back. Whatever it was, it made me want to come back there again. And so I did. Alcohol made me willing. That's what made me willing to come to AA, and then by the time I had made those slips, I was willing to do anything. I was dying. I was just freaking dying from this. Lost everything that my grandpa told me I was supposed to love and take care of. But I chose a bottle before them all. So one thing I knew I had to do was to get a sponsor. I knew that was one of the things I had to do. And there was no Indians there, so I'm going to have to ask some white guy to be my sponsor. So I watched this one man, and he was about 6'5 or 6'6. He actually was an attorney, a sober a long time. His face was all scarred up. And I think he was hit with an ugly stick when he was a baby. That man was ugly. But he had something about him that was appealing to me. I don't know what it was. And so I went and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said, after the meeting, he said, we're going to talk about it. So we had this cup of coffee. By then, this was in York Street in Denver. And so we sat there, and I guess he kind of had his attorney stuff, but it's like he was sizing me up. He was, you know how they look down and he look up, you like, he was looking up and down me like this, you know, and he would shake his head like that, and his eyebrows was down, you know, and he said, I don't know what's with you Indians, he said. I've been in this 15 years, and he said, you guys just don't get it. He said, you guys are really, really weird. You sat way in the back of the room, he said, and you never say nothing. Just pass, he said. That's all you ever say is just pass. And he said, I don't know. He said, you, and he was talking like this, you know, you guys are weird and you don't get it. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience when you're a little kid, your parents bought you a puppy, and then you tease that puppy, you know, it's like you rub it in the face to try to get it to growl. You know, you just keep playing with it, and then it starts to... That's what I felt he was doing to me, you know. You Indians don't get it, and you... And I remember I just raised my head and I looked him in the eye and I connected with Natashniha, you know, really strong. I connected to him. I didn't say it out loud because he's so big, but I thought to myself, I thought, you white son of a bitch, I'll show you, I will get it. But later on, I found out how wise that man was. Because the only emotion that he had to work with was my anger. I didn't feel nothing about nothing or nobody, but the anger, I had the anger. And so he just like kept me mad, on the verge of being mad. And I never liked him. So he told me, he said, he grabbed this big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he opened it up and he showed me how many pages was 164 pages. And he was holding those pages in his hand and he said, I just decided right now, he said, I'm going to be your friend for the rest of your life. He said, I don't care whether you like me or not. It's got nothing to do with you. I just decided I'm going to be your friend. He said, but if I'm going to sponsor you, I'm going to tell you some things I'm not. He said, I'm not your banker. Don't ask me for no money. He said, I'm not your hotel. You can't stay at my place. I'll tell you that right now. And he had this list of things that he said he was not. And he said, but I will be your friend. And then he showed me these pages in that big book, AA. And I had read that book. It's the most boring book I ever read. I was always looking there for these instructions you guys was talking about. Could never find them. And he said to me, in this book, this is AA. And he said, if you are willing to do exactly what's in these 164 pages, he said, you will never have to drink again. And I tried all kinds of things not to drink again. But to have somebody tell you that there was a way, that if you did exactly this, you'd never... He said, this program's not about slipping. This program is about getting sober and staying sober no matter what happens in your life. That's what it will tell you how to do. So he had me look at these pages that had the 12 steps on it, the 12 proposals. And he said, before you even do the work, he said, I want you to look at each of these 12 steps. And you got to come back to me and tell me the answer to two questions for each of these 12 steps. Read the step, and then this was the question. Are you willing to go to any length to do that step? The second thing is, do you want to do that step? And I remember when he was explaining this to me, I was over his place and he was making some lunch and he was making me a peanut butter sandwich. He knew I liked peanut butter sandwiches. And he said, you know, AA is like a banquet. And one end there's like steak and lobster and then you can move down and then there's like meatloaf and down to cheeseburgers. And I'm eating this sandwich, you know, and talking. He says, way on the... On this end, he said, where you're sitting, he said, that's where they call peanut butter sobriety. And there I'm chewing this sandwich, you know, sitting there sick as hell. You know, sponsors, you know, they're always, at least mine, he was always tweaking on me all the time. I remember we'd be in a meeting together, and you ever have that when your sponsor's trying to get your attention? You know, they're trying to connect that with that Natashniha or whatever. And you look all, you know, you do everything you can not to have them look at you. And so finally you got to look at him because that feeling's so strong. And I look over at him and he take his tongue and he go. He always said that peanut butter sticks to the roof of your mouth, you know. Because it was his belief. He said, half AA, they don't work no steps and they stay sober. He said, that's why you don't have to work steps, stay sober. But he said, if you want the steak, if you want the lobster, and you're willing to go any length, the instructions are in his 164 pages. So then he took a meeting schedule in Denver, and he circled six meetings. I had to go to a meeting every night. Big book meeting, tradition meeting, certain discussion meeting, step meeting. Sunday was my meeting of choice. And he said, you go to these meetings, and he said, when you get in there, he said, you just say your name is Don. You tell him you're alcoholic. And then he said, just shut up. Don't say nothing. Until you've taken a third step. Then you can share. But before that, he says, shut up. You got nothing of any value to anybody. And so I did that. I went and I was, I knew I was talking about my life. I was talking about whether I live or died. I got that. I started understanding a book where it talks about the day will come when you have no mental defense against that first drink. I know what that means. I know that one. No matter what the loss, that day comes. It's scary if that statement is true. And I was doing really good, and I was in that book, and I was doing the work, and there was a meeting there in a place called Eagle Lodge. And that was a meeting I went to, and I made coffee. I come and I sit down at the table, and who walks in this meeting but this Indian gal? Nice. And she was looking at me that way. In the Indian country, that look, we call it snagging. She had that snagging look in her eye, I could tell. And boy, my mind was just racing, you know, and I said, you know, you're not going to make any progress here if you just say your name's Don the alcoholic and that's all you're going to say. You're going to have to do something. So it come my turn, time to speak, and man, I was on 449, and boy, I was page 86, and I was quoting that big book, and that Indian gal got the big old smile on her face. She knew she had a winner. I could tell. She was looking. And we did go for coffee. And I did give her my phone number. And she took it. And so anyway, that night I was walking back to this little apartment that I had, and I was walking down a sidewalk like that movie where John Travolta is. You know that one? I walk in the door, and I opened up, the phone's ringing. I said, she couldn't wait. Baby couldn't wait. She wanted me. So I pick up that phone, and I'm trying to be really cool, you know, hello. No, it was Frank, the sponsor. What the hell you doing moving your lips? Sponsors are like the internet. They're just everywhere and they hear everything. You ever notice that? But with his help, he started to show me the instructions that was in that big book. First 43 pages had to do the first half of step one, where I was to look at my issues around powerless over alcohol. And myself, I had to read that. He made me read it 25 times. So I had to like read it, put a mark, four marks, draw a line through. He said, what's in there? There's not much. He used to call my mind, he said, in your mind, he said, you live like an inner ghetto. That's what he called my mind. And he said, what we're trying to do is to get you to not go in there alone. Because every time you do, you mug yourself. And And so then we got to that, and then he showed me the instructions on page 52 of the big book, was the 9 instructions for the second half of step 1 concerning unmanageability. He showed me this paragraph. We were having problems with relationships. Then I had to take that and flip it into a question, and I had to take a look at, am I having issues with relationships? Not them, but when I'm in the relationship, how am I acting? Do I shut up? Do I run? Do I put them down? Do I get even? And as I went down my list of personal relationships, I couldn't see a human being in there that I wasn't manipulating or that I knew how to get along with. I didn't know how to get along with people. I only know how to try to use them. Couldn't control our emotional nature. So I had to take a look at my emotions. When I'm in anger, how am I acting? When I'm in self-pity, how am I acting? And I began to see I was an emotional basket case. I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know what that meant. And so I had to take a look at all nine of those areas and go over that with him. And when we got that done, then I had to take those 9 areas, because the way he explained it to me, even though the steps, there's 12 of them, they're all interconnected with each other. They're not separate. It's a big interconnected process. And so I had to take those 9 areas from step 1, and I had to take them to step 2. And then I had to create 9 little mini visions, personal relationships. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore to sanity. Then what would it look like if I was effective in relationships? If the Creator said, this is how you could be in relationships. So I had to make 9 mini visions in each of those areas. And when I got that done, he said, this vision, this is what will be your spiritual awakening in step 12. And that's all you get, no more, no less. Additions to the vision will be made in inventory, in the fear inventory and in the sex inventory. And so I did as I was instructed, and then we went on to step 3. And he was a believer that every sentence in that big book was an instruction. If there was a question, you had to answer the question. But I had to relate that to my experience, being convinced we're at step 3. So I had to take a look at, was I an actor? Was I manipulating people? Did my life run on self-propulsion? And so as I looked at that, but I had some problems that I didn't really discuss with him, but I had some problems with this concept of God. I was raised on a reservation. On a reservation, we went to the boarding schools. And there was one church on the reservation, and whoever church had the missionaries, then that's who did the deal, right? And so they always gave you watermelon and clothes and food, but you always had to hear the sermon first. Then you got to, and so the parents, they would send us all to these schools, you know, and then you had to do their ceremonies, I guess. So some of them, we go there and you had to learn, and you were all looking at one another, and you had to do this, you know, and then you go in there and get the clothes and cookies and stuff like that, and that's fine. Then, of course, they'd run out of money, and then a month or so, a new one would come in there. They get everybody together, and they say, boy, you're lucky those guys aren't here, because they're all going to hell. We're the ones here that's got the way for you to go. And so then pretty soon you were the next religion. But they always had something in common. You didn't get the clothes or the watermelon or the food till after the sermon. So then pretty soon you didn't do this anymore, but you had to, you know, be doing this other one. And you know, if you're a little Indian kid, a nun is really scary. In those days they wore those habits. You know, they call them habits like that. And they kept rulers up their sleeves. And they would try to teach you about God, the concept of God, I guess. And they would say things like, they say, you ever been burned with a cigarette? Yeah. Well, when you go to hell, your whole body is going to be burning like that. Now, you want to see God? You say, you bet I do. You see, I do, you know. Or they say, you ever been thirsty? Well, there ain't no water in hell. Your body's going to be blistering. There ain't no water. And so, man, you would just... Well, that was a concept that God I had, and I didn't see God like how you taught me. It was like I had the flames of hell licking my ass, you know. You bet I do. Then, of course, I come to you guys, and you're saying to turn my life over to it. So I don't think so, you know. I didn't know what you guys were, but anyway... The way I was sponsored, he told me that whatever meeting you go to, you listen from the step that you're on. It's the only problem you got in your life, is the step that you're on. I had no other problems, he used to say. And so I'd always listen from the point of view of step three. And I remember in York Street, this guy come from California, and he told this story that allowed me to take step three. And some of you heard it, but I'll tell you too anyway. He said there was this pond, and in this pond there was a log, and there was four frogs sitting on that log, in the pond on that log. And he said one of those frogs made a decision to jump in the water. He said, how many frogs are left?
Four.
But I said, three. He said, no. The only difference is one of the frogs made a decision to jump in the water. But he said what the third step means is that when you make that decision, then God makes you an orange frog. So you're three green frogs. One made the decision to become an orange frog. And he said, once you decide to become an orange frog, that's it. You're an orange frog. And it used to get me mixed up because coming into AA, I'd hear this stuff, you know, about the will. Well, I turned it over and I took it back and I took it back and I turned it over and I turned it over and I took it back and you go, you know, how the hell do you take a third step when you keep doing that? But he said, once you take that third step and become an orange frog, then he says, let's say you do that on a Monday, then Wednesday you get all pissed off. And it's got nothing to do with the will. He says, you're just a pissed off orange frog. Duh. He said, then what happens on Sunday if you go get drunk? You're a drunk orange frog. And somehow where my mind was, click, I got the third step. So I remember I went over to Frank and I was so excited. I called him up. I said, ready to take the third step. And I walked in the door and I said, man, I said, I'm ready. I want to take the third step. I want to become orange frog. And he just, you know, he just... drives them nuts, you know, about that. But anyway, we did. That night, me and that old man, we got on our knees, opened up that big book, and he read that third step prayer, turned the book to me, and I read that third step prayer. Now I asked him when we were done, I said, what's next? He reached behind his chair and he pulled out a tablet, a pencil, and a ruler. And by the time I left there, I had known how to write a 5-column resentment inventory, a 4-column fear inventory, and an 11-column sex inventory. And what he told me to do was, on the top of every page, you write this prayer. God, help me to be honest. God, help me to remember. And God, give me courage to do this inventory. And so I started writing like I was taught. One thing I didn't know what was going to come up in my first inventory was my sexual abuse. Back on a reservation, I was sexually abused by an uncle for almost 3 years. And one night, there was a big beer party on the res. And he got in a fight, and somebody emptied a gun in his chest to kill him. And I remember the next day when I heard that news. I was very, very happy. That was a secret I kept. Never told nobody. But it affected every area of my life, affected relationships and risk-taking and made me want to run and all kinds of self-esteem issues. And nobody knew. I couldn't even feel. The impact of sexual abuse is devastating when it happens to you. I was just a little boy. but it was there. I didn't know it until I got into inventory and started looking at underlying causes. Like in relationships, I always give two messages. Like, come on, come on, come on. Go away, go away. No, no, come on, come on, go away. Come on, no, no, come on, go away. I drive them crazy. And they could feel the walls that I would build, especially if they got close. I could feel them. I knew I was a wall builder. I was afraid to let them get too close. I, in my mind, if somebody got really close, I create a plan on where I would go when it broke up. That was my commitment. Now, do you think that person could tell that I was a runner? Yeah, you see, they could. But I didn't know. I didn't want to be, but I didn't know that. And so I went ahead and I wrote that inventory. And when it was done, I knew it was good. There was some sick stuff was in there, sexual stuff, legal stuff, court stuff. And I never knew how it was I was to look at myself. I didn't know how to do that until I come to you guys. And you guys showed me the hurt that I caused other people. And when my inventory was done, I went and I fifth stepped it. But I did a funny thing with the fifth step was I took all the dark crannies, the sick shit, and I kept it in another piece of paper and I stuck it in my pocket. So when I got down to the fifth step, this man I fifth stepped with, he said, "Is that all?" I said, "Yeah, that wasn't that bad, you know, it wasn't too bad." He said, "I'm going to make another pot of coffee." And then he started, while he was making coffee, he started telling me about what was on his first fifth step. He was a sick mother. He was really a sicko. And I remember he said, "You sure you don't have any more?" And I said, "You know, I just remembered I got this." You know. And remember, I remember when I was taking it out, I said, "I'm going to read what's on this paper, but if that son of a bitch tells on me, I'm going to tell on him too. He's sick too." So I went ahead and I did that. Then I was taught when it was done, I was to come home, review the proposals, withholding nothing. Every odd step has a set of promises, but the promises, there's a condition to them. You ever notice that? Withholding nothing, you get a cookie. Withhold something, no cookie. So it's the same way, that freedom in the fifth step. And I remember he said, "I'll sit by the phone. If something comes up, you call me." And when I was done, I withheld nothing. I told the Creator, I told myself, I said out loud some really sick stuff. Then I started to read those promises. You can look the world in the eye. And I started to cry. First time ever. I knew what that meant. I could look the world in the eye. Getting rid of those secrets. Those secrets had a power as long as I kept them a secret. As soon as you share the secret, the secret loses its power. It doesn't have power over you anymore. And going and telling that. And so I did. And I claimed those promises. And then they taught me how to take the information out of the resentment, fear, and sex inventory and bring that in for steps 6 and 7. Steps are all interconnected with each other. And then eventually I got into the amends. And in the amends I started to learn about forgiveness. And I learned that when I say I'm sorry, there's a difference between say I'm sorry and there's a difference between that and forgiveness. When I say I'm sorry, it means I take the responsibility for my actions. And forgiveness is an act that I go and try to set the world right. I learned in that process, along with the help of the elders, there's 4 directions of forgiveness. There's a normal forgiveness. In the South, there's forgiving the unforgivable. That one's hard. In the West, there's forgiveness of self. That can be harder than forgiving the unforgivable. You ever just do something stupid? Then only you know it. And then in the north is the forgiveness. This is a forgiveness that you do to set another person's spirit free. You don't have to forgive them, but you do it to allow them to go on. You allow them to do that. And then I got in 10, 11, and 12 where I started to get some of the balance. It didn't take right away. I do go through a set of steps every year. That's how I was taught. Not everybody has to do that. There's different ways that people look at it. But I was taught to go through them every year, and I have done that. I've made 32 passes through those 12 steps. Eventually, I run into another sponsor. His name was Johnny Looking Cloud. He was both a traditional man. He was sober around 40 years then. And what he taught me was to take the steps and put them in a circle. Steps 1, 2, 3 in the east. That's like a new sun, new day. That's the direction that you find your relationship with the Creator. In the south is steps 4, 5, 6. That's where you find your relationship with you. You know your strengths, you know your weaknesses. Step 7, 8, 9 in the west, that's where you go in the forgiveness direction, like sunset, let it go. And you go back and make yourself right with all other human beings that you hurt, that you went out of harmony with. And then 10, 11, 12 is in the elder's direction. It's in the north. And so through AA is where I really started to return to my native culture, and I started to understand the true spirituality of native culture. I didn't know that before, but you taught me. You gave me back the culture. Understanding the ceremonies. Understanding the powers in that spiritual world. You guys taught me that. It seems like of anything that I know that is of any value, I learned from you. My family is all sober. My grandbabies, we have broken a cycle of addiction in my family. My grandbabies don't know. NAA is you know, there's 12 steps, like I'm going to close with this, but when Indian culture, when something is sacred, then what you do is you're supposed to stand up. Like when veterans walk in their uniform with their eagle feathers, everybody stands up out of respect. Or if certain elders, they walk in, you stand up out of respect. I have such respect for these 12 steps when I hear them being read. Like in a meeting, I have to tell myself, don't stand up. Just sit down, because that's the group conscience, how they do it. But if I had my druthers, I would stand up out of respect every time I hear them. They're the most powerful, powerful thing that I know. And I think what really made my heart smile is walking around. I never thought I'd stand in front of such an honored group of young people. Bill Wilson said, AA is going to be in good hands. I think that's true. I think you guys got it. So I want to tell you what that feeling was. Very, very first meeting, what that feeling was. I remember one time I was back to a reservation. I was drinking, and I was raised in hell, and I was doing a lot of bad things there. And my family, they took me in a car. They took to the edge of the reservation line where they catch the bus, and they said, we want you to get out of here. They said, don't come back here no more. We don't want you here. You're too destructive. Don't ever, ever come back. And so I did. I got on the bus and I left. Some years later, I came to you guys. And what you fools said was, keep coming back. That's why you feel like a tribe. You're like tribal to me. When I walk in here, I feel like, that feeling was like I come home. I found my tribe. I found where I belong. The other ones, they said, don't come back. You said, keep coming back. Because you love me. Like how you guys say it. And I love you too. So I'll close with this prayer that I got from you guys. But this prayer goes, it says, God, thank you for what you've given me. God, thank you for what you've taken from me. And God, thank you for what you left me. Ikipa. Thank you very much.